Russia's foreign minister has blasted the United States for its unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. French demonstrators are in the streets to protest against a government-promoted bill that aims to fight what it calls Islamic radicalism. And South Korea reports its highest daily number of coronavirus cases so far, sparking fears that the country could lose control of the spread. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to Russia this hour, where Russia's foreign minister has blasted the United States for its unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and its reimposition of sanctions on Tehran.
We agree that the root cause of the problem concerning the JCPOA was a result of the U.S. withdrawal from the deal. The harsh raft of sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Iran is another root of the problem.
Lavrov said that the U.S.'s refusal to fulfill its commitments approved by the U.N. Security Council is unprecedented. He said Washington's attitude towards international law is arrogant, unconstructive, and damaging. The top Russian diplomat opposed linking other issues to the Iran nuclear deal, saying it cannot be amended or revised. He hailed Iran for fulfilling its commitments despite Washington's punitive measures. Lavrov said unilateral sanctions by the U.S., the EU, and their allies are in violation of international law. He said those sanctions also have negative consequences that must be taken into account by the United Nations. Meanwhile, Russia says it reserves the right to retaliate after Britain imposed sanctions against individuals over alleged human rights abuses. While the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman slammed the sanctions as unfounded, and politically charged Maria Zakharova warned that the punitive measures will have a negative impact on ties between the two countries. On Thursday, the UK imposed travel bans and asset freezes on three Russian individuals. It accused them of severe human rights violations in Chechnya. The ban was part of a coordinated move with the United States. Washington's sanctions targeted a number of Russians and individuals and firms over the same allegations. Russia said the U.S. measures will deepen a crisis in bilateral ties. French demonstrators are out on the streets of Paris to protest against a security bill the government says aims to fight what it calls Islamic radicalism. Well, the protesters say the bill would discriminate against Muslims in France. Chris Dehan in Paris has the details.
But against a new bill that will be discussed in the French National Assembly about separatism. What is called under separatism is meant Muslim or Islam separatism, because I just talked to one of the organizers who explained that this is not about Christian separatism or Basque or Corsican separatism. It's targeted, the Muslim community is clearly targeted by this new bill, which is a new setback on democratic rights. Now, what we see here is a convergence of struggles. You have yellow vest people who are demonstrating, associations against police violence, and also Muslim associations who are victim already from this restricted law, because one of the main Muslim association defenders, the CCIF, has been dissolved by the new government. So this is a really restrictive second new law that will be debated, and the protest is always going on.
Homeless people have also taken to the streets of the French capital, Paris, to voice their anger at the housing crisis in that country. Demonstrators called on the government to apply a law that allows the requisition of huge empty buildings. Our correspondent brings us more in Paris.
Give us a decent housing, requisition of empty buildings. That's what the protesters demand from the French government. With the support of human rights associations, these homeless or poorly housed people have made a list of huge empty buildings in the Paris area. They handed over this list to the police headquarters and required that the housing law be applied.
We can apply this law to house everyone, even the precarious homeless French. Thanks to this law, everyone can have a roof above his head. If everybody were housed, that would already resolve half of our problems. It would help us to continue other fights, like work and against discrimination. The requisition law exists. It has to be applied.
I don't have a house. I'm moving from here to there. Once they proposed me a studio with toilets and a bathroom outside, I was disappointed. Now it's been more than 3 years I'm demonstrating with this association, right to housing, because they do the right thing.
We have a law of requisition of empty buildings, housings, and offices, but it is not applied nowadays. In Paris, the prefecture, therefore the government, can apply this law of requisition. But we see that the politic of the government is to favor the property rights and the rights to speculate on property rather than right to housing.
300,000 persons are homeless or are poorly housed in France. The needs for decent housing are growing. The solution could be simple. In France, 3 million of buildings, houses, and apartments are empty. Millions of square meters of offices are left vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Denant, Paris.
Well, Britain's Royal Navy boats are being prepared to protect the country's fishing waters in case the UK and the EU fail to reach a post-Brexit trade deal. The vessels are on standby to guard British waters from EU fishermen in case of no deal on fishing rights after the Brexit transition period ends on December the 31st. Navy officers will also be allowed to board foreign vessels and arrest fishermen. Fishing has been one of the sticking points in talks, which are fast approaching their end on Sunday, with both sides saying no agreement is likely. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the talks over a post-Brexit trade deal with the EU are deadlocked.
The argument today is about the terms on which we trade with the European Union. And the issue at the moment is that they want, the talks in Brussels are stymied, deadlocked, because they want to keep us locked into a system by which every time they change their laws, we have to change our laws. And we don't think that's a brilliant idea.
Johnson said, however, that British companies will enjoy big opportunities in case of a no-deal Brexit. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also told bloc leaders that a no-deal is the most likely scenario. Meanwhile, Irish Prime Minister Micheál Martin said his country still hopes for a last-minute deal. Speaking after an EU meeting in Brussels, Martin said the Irish economy would be damaged in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Johnson and von der Leyen have given negotiators until Sunday evening to break the current deadlock. And now to South Korea, which has posted its highest daily number of coronavirus infections since the pandemic began. The country registered 950 new cases on Saturday, more than two-thirds of them in the greater Seoul area. That's a densely populated region, home to half of the country's 52 million people. Officials said the surge was, among other things, linked to a church and hospital in the area. South Korea's President Moon Jae-in said the situation is very grave. Our cases have spiked despite the government's tightening of social distancing rules earlier this week. In Japan, daily COVID infections on Saturday passed 3,000 for the first time. Infections have worsened there as winter has set in. Well, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized the emergency use of COVID-19 vaccine jointly produced by American drug maker Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech. The approval will pave the way for millions to be vaccinated in the world's hardest hit country. The coronavirus pandemic has killed nearly 300,000 Americans so far. The U.S. is seeking to inoculate 20 million people this month. Healthcare workers and elderly in care facilities are at the front of the line to receive the shots. The U.S. is now the sixth country to approve the vaccine after Britain, Bahrain, Canada, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico. The government says it is buying 100 million more doses of a second vaccine produced by Moderna. The two-shot regimen could be approved as early as next week. Meanwhile, the fast spread of COVID-19 has forced the local authorities in the Gaza Strip to impose a full lockdown on the enclave. Nearly 200 people have already died because of the deadly pandemic. Ashraf Shannon explains.
Local authorities in the Gaza Strip have imposed a two-day curfew starting Friday to help combat the spread of the deadly coronavirus. The tiny enclave has been witnessing a sharp increase in infections in recent weeks, bringing the number of cases to over 27,000. In late August, a full lockdown was imposed on the Gaza Strip for a period of 2 weeks after authorities confirmed the first coronavirus cases spread through the community.
We have imposed a full lockdown since early Friday. We will also impose a nighttime curfew throughout the week to break the chain of infections. We believe that these measures will bring down the number of infections. We are under heavy strain because of the pandemic, and we hope that these tough measures could slow down the spread of the virus.
Currently, about 350 coronavirus patients in Gaza require hospitalization, including 150 patients in critical condition. With only 180 ICU beds, Gaza hospitals are having a very difficult time to save the lives of coronavirus patients. The extensive nature of the Israeli blockade has had a devastating impact on the enclave's health system, rendering it inadequate to respond to the coronavirus pandemic.
Gaza's health sector is suffering from a deteriorating condition because of the Israeli blockade. Lack of international funding and aid is also hampering efforts to fight the pandemic. The situation is heading towards a catastrophe amid the lack of medicines and testing kits. We are afraid that the coronavirus infections will continue to rise at a very fast pace.
Amid the current lockdown, the movement of people and vehicles all over the Gaza Strip is prohibited. People here are bracing themselves for the worst as COVID-19 infections continue to increase at a fast pace. The impoverished coastal sliver is already under a crippling Israeli blockade amid the international community's silence and inaction. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has moved forward with a major arms sale to Morocco. Now, the package is worth $1 billion and include drones and precision-guided weapons. The White House has reportedly sent a notice to Congress about the potential deal. Now, this would be among the first drone sales under the Trump administration. The move comes after Washington announced a U.S. brokered agreement for the normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. Earlier this year, the U.S. offered F-35 jet fighters to the United Arab Emirates as part of a deal to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. The United Nations keeps issuing warnings about the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen while the displaced continue to suffer in the absence of any action by humanitarian organizations. Our correspondent in Yemen, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more in this report.
With the onset of the winter season, the displaced in Darawan camp in the Yemeni capital Sana'a are experiencing a difficult humanitarian situation as they lack even blankets to alleviate the severity of the cold that makes them sleepless, not to mention the spread of diseases and epidemics, as well as an acute shortage of food and medicine.
Our children suffer from flu and cold diseases, and our tents have caught in them, causing rainwater to get in, and we have nothing to do but seek refuge with God.
Most of the displaced in Darawan camp are from Sa'da and the border directorates with Saudi Arabia. They were forced to leave their areas and villages, which were destroyed by the Saudi artillery fire that has been going on for 5 years.
Until November of this year, the number of displaced people reached more than 4 million. Imagine this number amid a lack of assistance for the displaced.
The United Nations had warned again of thousands of Yemenis who were starving and at risk of death, UN Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs Mark Lowcock said Yemenis are starving because of a war that is pushing the country towards famine.
The United Nations' useless warnings continue while what Yemenis are waiting for is the lifting of the blockade to reduce their sufferings in a country that UNICEF has described as the most dangerous place on earth for children to grow up. Abdul Latif Al Washalib, Sana'a.
Well, years on from the war in Iraq, the actions of those who ousted Saddam Hussein during the Persian Gulf War are still under scrutiny for the crimes committed during the operation. But it seems that the international body organizing the investigation is abandoning the process, even though admitting that war crimes were committed in Iraq by British troops.
There's a certain set of rules when it comes to the act of war, setting out what can and cannot be done during an armed conflict. And should that law be breached, then the International Criminal Court, or ICC, is tasked with investigating and bringing guilty parties to justice. Yet it seems the court is losing its credibility, as the ICC has recently announced that it intends to abandon its inquiry into British war crimes during the Iraq War, leaving the victims of British atrocities in the country equally abandoned as they seek justice against the British military. However, in spite of the case being dropped, the prosecutor behind the investigation, Fatou Bensouda, has been left in no doubt that the British military committed no end of crimes while stationed in Iraq, leaving many questioning why the ICC would suddenly drop the case.
Yep, but obviously because Britain is one of the permanent five members of the Security Council. And on political grounds, Britain has actually been fairly supportive of the International Criminal Court, even when its close ally and boss, in fact, the US, has fought against it. The British have stood by it, and they've been fairly consistent on it.
So what then are the allegations against the British? Crimes that have said to have been committed include willful killing of innocent civilians, torture of prisoners of war, inhumane and cruel treatment, and rape, all of which are highly illegal under the international rules of conflict and hence constitute as war crimes. The decision by the ICC to drop the case is being blamed on the lack of evidence submitted by the British military, raising the question from Human Rights Watch as to why the UK government has repeatedly shown little interest in investigating the crimes committed by its army. However, the British are no strangers to turning a blind eye to their crimes, as demonstrated through their brutal occupation of states during their imperial days, with the British also having been involved in conflicts in Afghanistan, the north of Ireland, and elsewhere. It remains to be seen as to whether the war crimes seen in Iraq have not been emulated elsewhere, and much like these, left to be forgotten in the past, just like the victims who were subjected to the British crimes.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The Biden-Harris administration is building an experienced criminal team by nominating for some top policy posts as well, including Secretary of State, Secretary of Homeland Security, National Security Advisor, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, among others. This will surely help extend America's interventionist policies in Muslim heartlands through diplomatic channels. This is not about looking to enter a new era of U.S. foreign policy, but rather trying to step back into the pre-Trump world. This is while America's endless war is pretty much universally recognized as the worst foreign policy blunder in its 21st century history. Yet now, Biden wants to reward them for it. He says, no retreat from Clinton, Bush, and Obama years here. And all this and more are bad news not only for the war-stricken people of the West Asia region, but Palestine and elsewhere. The Biden administration will definitely move to suppress Palestinian rights as well, even the BDS campaign, a peaceful protest movement protected by the UN Charter. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, which is published under the heading, The Empire of Chaos is Back Under Biden. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Joe Biden has announced infamous nominees for his national security and foreign policy team. He says America is back and ready to lead the world. The former vice president's comments are an apparent reflection of what the world community should expect under his foreign policy mandate, because his team reflects the fact that America is once again ready to mess with the world for all the wrong reasons. Under the circumstances, expect Biden to not retreat from America's endless wars. It will also sit once again at the head of the United Nations Security Council table, releasing sanctions resolutions to confront sovereign nations with much-needed help from Western allies, ready to stand up for the bogus war on terror et al. To this end, he has picked Antony Blinken, a former Obama administration official and longtime Biden aide, who has a history of pushing for U.S. wars and military interventions in places like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. The idea is to rebuild trust in the war state and bogus alliances. He has also picked Avril Haines to be his Director of National Intelligence, who served as both the Deputy Director of the CIA and the Deputy National Security Advisor under Obama. Haines has a racist history of running cover for CIA torture programs and served under former CIA Chief John Brennan when the Obama administration criminally increase drone strikes in places like Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, and North Africa. He also helped crush anti-racism protests at home. No wonder human rights groups and peace activists have sounded the alarm over Biden's picks. These are the same criminals that launched endless wars against dozens of Muslim states in the West Asia region and played key roles in drone strike policy during Barack Obama's presidency. These are also the same goons that covered up the torture perpetrated by members of George W. Bush administration. Biden says preparations for more of the same are expected to follow. The Biden-Harris administration is building an experienced criminal team by nominating for some top policy posts as well, including Secretary of State, Secretary of Homeland Security, National Security Advisor, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, among others. This will surely help extend America's interventionist policies in Muslim heartlands through diplomatic channels. This is not about looking to enter a new era of U.S. foreign policy, but rather trying to step back into pre-Trump world. This is while America's endless war is pretty much universally recognized as the worst foreign policy blunder in its 21st century history. yet now Biden wants to reward them for it. He says no retreat from the Clinton, Bush, and Obama years here. All this and more are bad news not only for the war-stricken people of the West Asia region, but Palestine and elsewhere. The Biden administration will definitely move to suppress Palestinian rights as well, even the BDS campaign, a peaceful protest movement protected by the UN Charter. He won't change course from Trump's State Department policies in his respect. Quite the opposite, the ex-Obama administration staffers will target and suppress support of Palestinian human rights everywhere, even at the UN. It is going to be pretty much business as usual for other nations as well, meaning huge war spending, a heavy US footprint in the world, and this outdated notion that the US should be at the head of the table when it comes to human rights and international human law. The ex-Obama administration staffers will create legal justification for Biden's drone wars and support for further blockades on Yemen, Syria, and Gaza. At the same time, leading human rights groups and the UN Human Rights Watch speak out fervently against these criminal policies, but to no avail. There is a saying in Washington that personnel is policy. As things stand, the ex-Obama administration staffers or Biden's group of national security picks are all war criminals and should be held to account at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The world will not sleep easier until they are brought to justice. They are not picked to end America's endless wars. And certainly, this is unfortunate news for many war-stricken countries in the West Asia region. They are in no way picked to undo Trump's damage or Obama's damage. And certainly, they cannot build a more compassionate and common-sense foreign policy agenda for the United States of America. Put simply, they are excellent choices to help extend the destructive reach of the empire of chaos on this planet of ours. What else do you expect from a former vice president that backed the illegal wars on Iraq and Syria and drone bombing campaigns in countries like Pakistan and Yemen? This is also the same politician that, in 1990s, co-sponsored a bill with John McCain to send troops into Yugoslavia and later advocated a troop surge in Afghanistan and aerial warfare in Syria and Yemen. He's now telling us that the U.S. must take the same devastating lead in the policing the world. The strategy of global military domination with help from his scandalous circles.
Africa Today.
A nearly three-decade-old ceasefire has ended in occupied Western Sahara, marking the onset of upcoming tensions in the region.
The opposing sides are the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement that seeks independence from the monarchy.
The Polisario is mobilizing thousands of volunteers to join for the fight after the Moroccan military broke into Guerguerat, a restricted area technically under Polisario sovereignty.
Morocco has publicly and officially acknowledged the fact of launching an armed attack on a group of civilians demonstrating peacefully in Western Sahara.
I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya.
And I am Ikram Abdikarim. Welcome to Africa Today. In this episode, we take you to the Western Sahara, where open warfare appears to be on the horizon.
Now, fighting has reportedly broken out in several areas between the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, and it could have impacts far beyond Morocco.
I have also prepared news from all over Africa for you. Stay with us for the next 25 minutes.
Tensions in Africa's last colony.
I say that our damnation comes from the natural resources we have here. If it wasn't for these natural resources, Morocco would never have invaded Western Sahara.
If we don't speak out, especially us as victims who have suffered all of this, if we don't speak out and defend our cause, this problem will remain.
Hostilities began after a Morocco-built road was reportedly blocked by the Polisario, and the kingdom's trade route with Mauritania was cut. Violation of the ceasefire after 29 years since it was clinched could undermine peace and security in the rest of the region. The ceasefire agreement was reached between the Polisario Front and Morocco after several engagements between 1989 and 1991.
We are sure, as we are sure that God exists, that the Saharan people's objective is independence. And that is a right we must address today, tomorrow, next year, in our time, in our children's time. It doesn't matter when. The important thing is to achieve national independence. The conditions we are living in, the weakness in policy and failures of the Moroccan kingdom, the importance of the Saharan case in the world today and the focus of Saharan people on independence are indicators that victory is imminent. Independence is imminent.
The kingdom has managed to occupy and administer 80% of the territory.
Since then, thousands have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation.
The media blockade Moroccans have imposed on Western Sahara is also quite infamous.
We are now joined by Mr. Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest from London. Mr. Hamdi, thanks for joining us. Now, can you walk us through the latest round of violence in Western Sahara?
There is a road that goes from Morocco to Mauritania that is used for the transport of goods. There was a protest that took place from the inhabitants of the Western Sahara. The Moroccan government accused these groups of being part of the Polisario. It's not clear if they were. So they sent in the army, which fired warning shots. The Polisario say that the Moroccans actually fired on the protesters. And the Moroccan army moved into that area, which is a buffer zone, and built a sand wall in order to try to prevent that road from being blocked again. The Moroccans believe that the Polisario are trying to force a new war, and the Polisario believe that the Moroccans are further cementing their de facto control of much of the territory.
Thanks for that, Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief, the International Interest Magazine.
Western Sahara has been occupied by Morocco since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. Although the four-decade-old conflict has its roots in nearly a century of brutal colonization by Spain. Madrid agreed to hand over Western Sahara to Mauritania and Morocco in 1975, triggering tensions that continue to this day.
On the 21st of October, Polisario bring women and children and block the crossing point of Gargarat. Immediately, the Secretary General have been alerted by Morocco, and we alerted also the Security Council. And since 21st of July of October, Secretary General made two calls to Polisario to withdraw from Gargarat, not to block civil and commercial traffic, and also not to change the statutes of this area.
Pro-independent Sahrawis living in the occupied territory stage more and more protest against the Moroccan rule established with the help of the United States.
Morocco reportedly took military action hours after U.S. Major General Andrew Rohling met with the commander of the Royal Moroccan Armed Forces Southern Zone.
We are now joined by Mr. Edward Corrigan, an international lawyer from Ontario, to hear his take on the significance of this meeting.
Well, obviously, the United States is a supporter of the Kingdom of Morocco. Morocco is considered a conservative Arab government. It's under, you know, very, you know, quietly supported by the Americans. And obviously, the American generals gave green light to Morocco to for any invasions or going into the buffer zone. So the Americans are definitely involved. Morocco has, you know, a history of a poor human rights record, not only in the old Spanish Sahara, but also in its own country. And there's some allegations that the Polisario Front also has some human rights problems.
Now, relations between the Moroccan and the U.S. militaries have grown in recent years, mostly thanks to cooperation over the American military command in Africa, AFRICO.
Just recently, the United States and Morocco signed an accord that aims to strengthen military operations over the next decade.
Morocco hosts one of the largest training exercises organized by AFRICOM. It's called the African Lion Annual Exercise, where countries from all over Africa participate. It's usually held provocatively, I think, in southern Morocco, not too far from Western Sahara. So it certainly it's not good optics that Morocco chose to launch this military incursion in violation of the UN ceasefire on the same day that military commanders were in Morocco preparing for the annual African Lion Exercise.
Now, Washington is the monarchy's largest supplier of arms, and it hosts an annual U.S. military exercise called African Lion. Morocco signed a peace treaty with the U.S. in 1786, which is still in force today.
The Moroccan government also enjoys support from some U.S. region allies, such as Turkey and the UAE.
I think the U.S. has been trying to deploy as much as it can in terms of leverage in order to push other countries to normalize ties with Israel, whether that's by making promises of recognizing Moroccan control of the Western Sahara, or whether that's by making promises of incentives to push Morocco to assert what it believes is its right to the Western Sahara. This is all possible. However, it's not a guarantee that Morocco necessarily responded to these U.S. demands. The reality is that there were the road was blocked. There were protests. The Polisario have acknowledged that as well. It does affect transport of goods between Morocco and Mauritania.
The latest round of tensions in the rest of region could spiral out of control. Neighboring Algeria, which is home to Sahrawi refugees, could be dragged into the conflict, potentially causing an all-out war. Major weapon sales to Morocco by the Trump administration have even raised concerns, yielding a scenario which Morocco might be looking for a U.S. recognition of Western Sahara in exchange for Rabat's recognition of Israel.
إسرائيل ليست عدوا للمغرب على أي حال ليست عدوا للمغرب بل في الماضي قدمت بعض الخدمات استعلاماتية واستخباراتية
على كل حال هذا ما يقوله محور معين في الإقليم
هذه هي الحقيقة يا أستاذة
بالنسبة لك هناك محور آخر لا يعتبر هذا
يعني ليس
حقيقة
ليس هناك احتقان إسرائيلي أو حقد إسرائيلي على المغرب
The U.S. even got close to recognizing Western Sahara as Moroccan territory under the George W. Bush administration. Meanwhile, the Sahrawi civilians remain the true victims, wary of empty promises by the U.N. Security Council and the U.N. Secretariat, and no resolution in sight.
This is all part of the mess that the Europeans created after in Africa, where they divided up the country in the 1984 Berlin Conference. But, you know, all of the countries and the lines and the map, you know, really don't correspond to the ethnic groups in the area and linguistic groups. So, you know, that's why there's so much instability in Africa, where these countries are, you know, trying to live under these artificial lines. And as I've read elsewhere, Africans just sort of ignore the lines. They just do whatever they want. So that's the issue. So until the Americans get serious and the European Union gets serious.
And now my colleague is ready to present you with news and events from across Africa. What do you have in store for us today, Kram?
Thank you, Henya. Welcome back to more news from all over Africa. And now, on to the first one. World's white giraffe has been fitted with a track device in Kenya to protect it from poachers, as one white female and her cow were killed by poachers in March. Its white appearance is due to leucism, which causes skin cells to have no pigmentation. Parliament approves deal for Rwanda Air to fly to 5 new routes. Rwanda ratified agreements with Brazil, Democratic Republic of Congo, Namibia, Somalia, and Tunisia, bringing the total number of bases ratified by Parliament to 52. The country is also expected to sign agreements with South Korea and Malta. Thirdly, Burkina Faso election takes place amid terrorist threats. People have voted in Burkina Faso's presidential election, although polls are closed in parts of the north and east because of fears of terrorist violence. Now, clashes with police sparked by the arrest of Ugandan presidential candidate and former pop star Robert Chagulani, commonly known as Bobby Wine, has left at least 28 people dead since Wednesday. He was later charged with spreading coronavirus at a campaign rally. Police in Uganda have a right to shoot protesters dead if they reach a certain level of violence, Security Minister Eli Tamwini has said. Also in West Africa, Nigerian photographer Obinna Obioma is using creative ways to display an iconic West African plastic bag to reflect on migration. Recognized around the world in either its blue-white and red-white varieties, this once nameless bag in West Africa has long been especially popular in markets across the region. Last but not least, Nigeria's economy slips into recession. Sixth Nigeria has slipped into recession, with the latest growth figures showing the economy's contracted 2.06% between April and June. The country has now seen two consecutive quarters of declining growth, the usual definition of recession. I hope you enjoyed the news. Don't forget to comment, and interactions are highly welcome. And stay tuned for more from me and the entire Africa team today. Thank you.
Tensions in Africa's last colony.
A full-blown military conflict in the disputed desert territory in northwest Africa could exacerbate the lives of locals already under pressure.
With a protracted war in Libya, long simmering insurgency in Mali, and an armed conflict in Ethiopia, hostilities in Western Sahara add to regional instability.
Now, the Polisario Front argues that the resumption of armed struggle is aimed at defending the legitimate rights of Sahrawis.
Frankly speaking, at the moment, it's very difficult to talk about any peaceful negotiations because Morocco has already launched a military attack on our land and our people, to which we have had to respond. So it all depends on how the developments on the ground. But if you just allow me very quickly to remind your viewers that the whole crisis started when Morocco launched an attack on a group of civilians who were protesting peacefully against Morocco's illegal occupation of Western Sahara, a violation that the United Nations...
The sparsely populated territory has worried international observers, who fear it could turn into a hub for terrorists. Natural resources are meanwhile being plundered from phosphates to fish.
Now, in order to isolate the southern part of the Western Sahara, Morocco also built a 2,700-kilometer sand wall in the 1980s, which is equipped with a barrier minefield, thought to be the longest continuous minefield in the world.
I think there's always a risk of that, but I do think that there is little appetite on both sides for an all-out war. And I think the key reason for that is that Morocco has been able to access the Western Saharan area and been able to invest and take advantage of the area economically. I think Algeria is not in the mood to get engaged in a conflict, given that the president is ill, given that the country is going through transition, given that the regime is under significant pressure from its own domestic situation, whether that's Corona or whether that's the popular protest. And Mauritania is engaged in a bitter political struggle, the third player in this in a bitter political struggle between the former president and the current president.
Rabat seeks to secure passage of trucks to Mauritania via Gargarat border crossing. Morocco has also played down the clashes occurred, asserting that the three-decade truce still stands. But does it? Morocco, on the other hand, says that its activities in Western Sahara are merely aimed at free circulation of civilian and commercial traffic with neighboring Mauritania.
This route is important when it comes to the movement of civilians and goods, and because such actions were a violation of the UN-sponsored ceasefire agreement, Morocco, in order to fulfill its duties, ordered its military forces to intervene and build a sand barrier to protect the area from any future breaches.
Morocco considers the resource-rich territory of Gargarat as the integral part of the kingdom. Gargarat is located on the southern coast of the disputed Western Sahara, along the road leading to Mauritania.
Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area, irrespective of the ceasefire lines, and Algeria has been able to benefit because it's always been able to use the Western Sahara as a way to keep Morocco embroiled in separate issues instead of antagonizing Algeria from Algeria's perspective. So it may well be that what Polisario is doing is trying to flex its muscles in given that Algeria itself is looking at other military priorities. Almost as the Polisario is saying, Algeria, we're still here, so make sure you continue to support us.
The Gargarat standoff exposes the vulnerability of Morocco's strategy of driving business growth as a major player in the sub-Saharan economy.
The latest round of violence also represents culmination of diplomatic failures to broker a sustainable peace deal to determine who controls Africa's last colony.
Now, after decades of disputes, Morocco's strategy appears to be refusing self-determination, and Polisario is rejecting Rabat's autonomy.
Power players in the region are also taking the chance to employ Western Sahara as a proxy for a wider struggle for influence in Northwest Africa. So, what repercussions can the conflict have for the region?
It depends if the regional countries are actually in favor of war. I think when it comes to analyzing the Polisario's propensity for war, or not propensity, if they have their desire for a renewed conflict, that all depends on the mood in Algeria, which is one of the prime backers of the Polisario, and the extent to which the Polisario believes that it will be able to secure international sympathy for its case, for its cause, for what's going on in the region. I do think that Morocco itself is not interested in a full-blown conflict. The reality is that both Morocco and Algeria, the two key international players in this conflict, are both happy with the status quo. Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area.
Different generations of Sahrawis have grown up in refugee camps in Algeria, with no resolution surrounding their fate as the indigenous inhabitants of the region. Yet for Rabat, Western Sahara is a matter of national security, and King Mohammed IV has threatened to respond to any threat severely.
The journalists, observers, and activists who come from abroad are expelled. So what do? We break through this blockade from within. We are the witnesses. I'm going to suffer. If I do this work, I suffer more, yes. I'm going to make more sacrifices. But if I don't, I will always live under occupation.
Rabat appears to be entrenching the occupation by betting on time in what it portrays as an ongoing political process. The process, which had already failed, now looks way more distant as new clashes break out and hostilities increase.
That would be serious. Of course, Morocco, I think, is looking for, seizing the resources of the area, and maybe, oil, gas, other things. And while Morocco has control of the seaside and 80% of the territory, the Polisario Front controls 20% along the Algerian and Mauritanian border. But it is, most definitely could explode into something very serious. But, we are talking about there's only 60,000 people, 600,000 people that live in the area.
The United Nations has expressed grave concerns over the possible consequences of the conflict, The UN has also vowed to do its utmost to avoid the collapse of the 1991 ceasefire.
A UN mission known as MINURSO is also present on the scene, but will any of that be helpful?
The Secretary General remains committed to doing his utmost to avoid the collapse of the ceasefire that has been in place since 6 September 1991. And he is determined to do everything possible to remove all obstacles to the resumption of the political process.
Just recently, the UN Security Council decided to extend the mandate of the United Nations peace operation in Western Sahara for another year.
Delegates also called for a swift appointment of a new personal envoy of the UN Secretary General to push for the Western Sahara peace process. Now the new clashes are presenting a new challenge to the world body, stopping an all-out war.
It's, you know, a low-level conflict, but it could easily explode into something much more serious and possibly bring in, Algeria into the conflict as well, as Morocco, and depending on what the Americans would do, but they've been supporting Morocco and have been consulting them and providing them arms. So, yeah, it could explode, but this conflict has been going on actually for many, many years, but since Spain withdrew in 1975, then Mauritania withdrew under pressure from the Polisario Front later. But it's not a densely populated area. There's a little over, not even 600,000 people in the area.
Thanks for that, Mr. Corrigan.
Today, Sahrawis have no reason to believe in the words of the UN, which promised a referendum in 1991, but has done nothing to make it actually happen. The native population is therefore fighting for freedom as more troops head to Moroccan positions along the separation wall.
I do think that the Polisario, which relies on international backing in order to stand up to Morocco, may find that international backing lacking in this current environment in which the region finds itself in, or in particular the current environment in which each of the individual countries find themselves in as a result of their domestic struggles.
According to some reports, the Moroccan military has shown weak performance in some instances, allowing Polisario forces to take over some positions easily.
As tensions soar, the Moroccan media has mostly remained silent as if nothing is happening.
This is why the Sahrawis' right to self-determination are being denied, a denial coupled with reports of heavy crackdown on protests. People are suffering, but the news never gets out.
That wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today.
And we pray for the end of violence and suffering all over the world.
Please know that your thoughts and comments are always welcome.
Until we come back again, it's goodbye from me, Mubarak Kenya.
And goodbye from me, Ikram Abdikarim, and the entire team.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.